Morning. Certainly nice to see all of you here today. It's nice to have the opportunity once again to be in front of you. I haven't done this for a while, so I might be a little bit rusty, so please bore with me. I want to do something a little bit different today. Hopefully, it's something that will be enjoyed by at least some and possibly by many. Hopefully nobody enjoys it too much because it's not something that I can do too very often. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start by reading a few scriptures to kind of set a tone. Then I'm going to tell you a story about somebody that I used to know and some very serious struggles that he had in life. And then I'm going to come back and try to tie that all together as to use this as kind of a metaphor of the Christian life. We see throughout the New Testament, particularly Jesus and Paul, frequently use images of physical life to teach spiritual lessons. They take things that people would be familiar with and say, okay, now that you understand that, use that concept to try to understand this spiritual concept over here. Of course, Jesus did that a lot when he talked about the kingdom of heaven is like. And he talked a lot of things about it, what it was like. So I'm hoping that through this story, I can show something of what a spiritual life is like. As I spend time reading my Bible, one thing that comes very clear to me is that there is a struggle that goes on in the world between good and evil. There's a global good and evil, but inside each of us, we have that battle as well. Basically, we have to decide every morning when we get up that I am a Christian and I am going to serve God and I am going to do the best I can. And there's going to be a lot of stuff out there that's going to try to take that away from us. So throughout the New Testament, there are many, many examples given of how this spiritual struggle goes. And again, there are referred to using physical ideas. And the one constant that seems to come through that occurs to me is that Christianity is not a spectator sport. Christianity is something that we have to be actively involved in and actively doing if we're going to be successful. So I want to talk about something that we see in the book of Revelation. We're all familiar with the seven letters to the seven churches in Revelation 2 and 3. And of course, at the end of each one of those, there is a statement that says what will happen. So we want to just take a look at, and I'm only going to read the very bit at the very end of each letter, so we're not going to read all through the letters or anything like that. But the first thing that we see is that there are things that are promised to people who overcome. Now, of course, these letters are talking about specific things, but it's easy to apply that to a Christian spiritual life. We are promised things that will happen to us if we overcome. So the first letter is to the church at Ephesus in Revelation 2:7, and at the end it says, "To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." To the church at Smyrna, in verse 11, the end says, "He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death." To the church at Pergamum, in verse 17, it says, "To him who overcomes, to him I will give of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it." To the church at Thyatira, in verses 26 through 28, at the end he says, "And he who overcomes, and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to pieces, as I also have received authority from my Father, and I will give him the morning star." To the church at Sardis, in chapter 3 and verse 5, he says, "He who overcomes shall thus be clothed in white garments, and I will not erase his name from the book of life. And I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." to the church at Philadelphia in verse 12. He says, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it any more, and I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name." And then lastly, the church at Laodicea, he says, "He who overcomes, I will grant to him to sit down with me on my throne, and I, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." Do you see a theme running through all of those things? Obviously, it says if we overcome, there are promises that will be given. What is the unstated contra to that? That if we do not overcome, we will not get those things. And as stated previously, this is an idea to try to take spiritual and convert it to our physical and convert it to spiritual. So I'm going to tell you the story of about a man named Wes Shearman, who was, I don't know if he was a Washington native, but he spent the vast majority of his life in the state of Washington, except for about 7.5 years where he was a guest abroad. He grew up here. He joined the Washington Air National Guard. He flew for Northwest Airlines. He spent more time in the National Guard, where he ended up going to Vietnam, where he ended up getting shot down on a mission. And he was a prisoner of the North Vietnamese for 7.5 years in Hanoi. And stories, I mean, there's hundreds of people that had the same thing happen, but there's very few stories that are written about what these people went through. Wes just happens to be one. There's a magazine article that he wrote many, many years ago that went through two issues where he basically lays out the whole thing. And so we get insight that we don't necessarily see. I had a chance to meet Wes much later in his life. Just for the end, he actually died in 2014 at the age of 78 from lung cancer. Fortunately, he didn't suffer for very long. He didn't know he had it. He fell down the stairs once. Couldn't breathe. They took him to the hospital. He had a deflated lung. They reinflated his lung and said, "Oh, by the way, you have lung cancer." So he thought he might be able to beat that because he beat so much more, but about 6 months later, he succumbed to it. Now, aside from all of his other things, he also founded a group up at Arlington called the Blackjack Squadron. Some of you have probably seen them. They used to fly overhead in little two-seat home-built airplanes in groups of 4, 6, 8, 10, something like that. They haven't been as active lately, but they used to be seen all over the skies here in Northwest Washington in years past. He and a friend of his were the ones that founded that many, many years ago. As he got older and he didn't really feel comfortable flying his little high-performance airplane, Vance had come out with a thing called an RV-12. Now, the last time I talked about this, it was suggested to me that there might be one or two people that don't know what an RV-12 is. So if you're one of those, that's an RV-12. In fact, that's the one my dad and I built. We happened to have one of the first ones in Washington State, and there were several other people building, so we just kind of naturally became people that others congregate or came to say, "Hey, how about this? How did you do this? What with this?" And that's how we met Wes. Nice guy, kind of a little guy, not the kind of person that you would look at and say, "Now that's a tough guy." But obviously, apparently, he is or was. As he completed his airplane, he asked me if he could fly with me so that he could kind of get used to the handling qualities of the airplane before he flew his own. And I'm like, okay. At the time that I flew with him and we helped him and stuff, I didn't know about this story. I knew that he had been flying longer than me. I knew he had a lot of experience. I think I knew he had flown for an airline, but I really didn't know just how experienced he was. And he was very, very grateful for the time. I mean, it was just a really cool thing. It was really sad for everybody at Arlington when he passed. So going back in 1965, he was in Vietnam. On August 27th, he was assigned to lead a mission against a military barracks area somewhere about 100 miles west of Hanoi. And since he was the flight leader, it fell to him to do all of the planning and everything. So he started doing research. They were flying F-105s. They wanted them to drop bombs that had not been used on F-105s before. And he said, are you sure this is a good idea? So he looked at all of the information and he says, I think this mission is a bad idea. And he told, the people he worked for, hey, I think this is a bad idea, but if you say it's important, yes, sir, we'll do it. So he went and started doing his planning. And of course, in the next morning when it was time for him to get ready, the authorities in Saigon said, yes, this is a priority mission. Go do it. And he said, okay. So they did all of their stuff. They got all of their briefing. They got the airplanes done. And of course, as they take off, the weather was really terrible. They're attacking a barracks, literally a bunch of buildings in the jungle, kind of out in the middle of nowhere, in a mountainous valley that was shrouded with clouds. What could go wrong? So they got everything off. Everybody took off. They formed up. They hit the tankers. They did everything. Everything's on schedule. And he's like, hey, this is really great. Everything is going according to plan. As they got to the target area, they got really lucky. There was breaks in the clouds. They could actually drop through the clouds to where they could see the target area. So there, they had a waypoint of a highway, and they were supposed to follow this highway to a certain point where the target was supposed to be. Well, they got there, and guess what? It's not here. He looks over here. It's like, oh, there it is over there. So now everybody's out of position to make their bombing run. So he has his second element go in and attack first. His element circles around to come in behind. The first group dropped their bombs. Apparently, there were some bomb malfunctions. So they decided that they would circle around again and make a gun pass over the same target. So now Wes is in the lead. He goes over, he pulls the trigger, starts shooting rounds into the target, and all of a sudden the gun stops firing. And he's like, that's strange. I'm holding it down and it's not firing. Then he hears a loud bang, and then the whole engine starts to shake, and he realizes he's got a real problem. Of course, one of his wingmen calls up and says, hey, boss, you're on fire. He's like, yeah, I think I'm getting out. So he's in this valley. He didn't have enough altitude to get across the mountain, so he's got no choice. He's got to go down in this valley. There's a hill that he sees out there. He's like, well, okay, I'm going to try to get out about that hill. Turns out what had happened is his gun had malfunctioned, and it was sending pieces of metal down the intake and destroyed his engine. His engine blew up. So basically, he shot himself down, which he was able to actually joke about, well, later. So he gets out of the airplane. He lands. He has some, difficulties with the ejection. He's actually injured, not badly, but he sliced his wrist. Apparently, he said it was bad enough that he thinks he severed a vein, so it was bleeding pretty profusely. He hit kind of backwards. As he ejected, the seat got tangled in his parachute. So he's here. His ejection seat is here. His parachute is here. And he's like, okay, that's not good. So as he's floating down, he's trying to untangle this thing so it doesn't land on top of him. So he hits the ground. Not terribly injured. He tries to stash all of this stuff. He's got his portable radio. He's talking to the rest of his flight. He's like, okay, I'm down. I'm safe. They're like, well, the rescue people are on their way in. He's like, okay, I'm on top of this hill. Tell them to hurry. No, I don't hear anybody else around. I think I'm by myself. He's looking for cover. There's no real cover. There's thick jungle around the bottom of the hill that he's on, but there's really nothing up there at the top of the hill. He's kind of exposed. So about 5 minutes later, he starts hearing voices. So he can hear North Vietnamese regulars coming up the hill. Apparently, they were loaded for bear, so they come to play. So he calls back his flight and says, tell the rescue people to go away because they'll just get shot down if they come here too. He says, I'll try to survive the night, and they can come pick me up in the morning. best laid plans of mice and men. That didn't work so well. He survived for maybe about an hour before they caught up to him. As soon as they captured him, the first thing they did was took away his boots. Then they tied him up. They tied his arms behind his back, looped the rope around his neck, and dragged it down to his feet and started shoving him down the hill. For the next couple of nights, he was in a cave with steel bars on the front of the cave. They loaded him into the back of a truck. They must have really thought he was a dangerous person. They loaded him in the back of a truck with 20 guards to take him to Hanoi. So he shows up at Hanoi to the main prison, which, of course, is referred to as the Hanoi Hilton. Actually, after all of this, I thought, hey, they made a movie about that. Let me watch the movie. You know, it's Hollywood, so it had the Hollywood stuff to it. So by the time he got to the prison in Hanoi, his mindset is like, okay, I'm not going to get rescued. I may be here for a while. I had better come up with a way to try to survive how we're going to do this. So he said, I arrived in Hanoi on the morning of 3rd September 1965. As the large iron gate at the entrance of Hualo prison slammed shut behind me, I knew I was beginning a new kind of war. Basically, it would be mostly a war of wills, theirs against mine. So he had a four-point strategy that was kind of trained into service people on how to deal with this. So point one is be military. Point two is don't discuss or argue politics. Three, don't ask for anything. And four, follow the code of conduct. Now, any of you who have been in the military are probably familiar with the code of conduct. It's kind of drummed into your head from pretty much day one. So now he's just kind of getting acclimated, and of course they want information from him and all of this other kind of stuff. So he said, after a few hours, I was escorted to my first interrogation, the first of many, day and night, for the next 10 days. I marched in, stood at attention, and saluted the interrogator. He returned my salute. The first round was mine. So he actually got him to goof up and return the salute by basically acknowledging that he was an equal. So, again, per the Geneva Conventions, every time they're asking questions, all he's giving is name, rank, serial number, date of birth. And as they try to ask more questions, he's like, well, you know, I can't tell you anymore by international law. The Vietnamese counter with, well, the Geneva Convention doesn't apply because you're not a prisoner of war. There's no declared war. You're a criminal in our country, and we will treat you however we want to. And if we want to kill you, we will do so. So one of the things that happened, he was number 23. He was one of the early people that was caught down. He said that by the time he left, he had memorized the name of 368 people. That had come through the facility. So that was one of the things they did, since there was no information getting out back to the States, is everybody tried to memorize everybody else's name so that if anybody got out, they could say, okay, these are the people that are there. Somebody had come up with a tap code. So they all learned Morse code, so you could communicate by knocking on the walls. Somebody had come up with a tap code that you could use either on the wall, or if you happen to be placed next to somebody, you could tap on their leg like this and you could communicate. Because, of course, if you spoke, they were very, very adamant that you cannot speak and you would be taken and tortured if you were caught communicating. So he said, after a few days, I was caught communicating, so I was placed in the stocks, which were built into the foot of the concrete beds, locked from the outside hall. In this position, one could only sit or lie on their back, but could not turn over, use the waste bucket, etc. I thought that to be restricted like this must be about the worst thing they could do to me. Little did I know. But he thought, after he made it through the first 24 hours, he said, well, okay, I made it through one day. If I could make it through one day, I can make it through another day. And if I make it through another day, I can make it through another day. So, you know, this whole concept of taking things one day at a time really does work. He knew somebody else who had gone a consecutive 128 days locked up like that. Just hard to believe. As time went on, he said, living conditions were becoming worse. The food consisted of a small plate of rice, a cup of thin weed soup, and maybe a couple of bites of pig fat or some kind of vegetable or root. This we received twice a day with a small pitcher of water. So basically, they were continually thirsty. Some more time went on, and he said the V, just for, you know, short for Vietnamese, then published camp regulations, which were about 10 rules, all of which boiled down to that we were considered not POWs but war criminals, and we were to do anything they said. Thus began the systematic torture that would last for the next 4.5 years. So it's interesting to think that people in such a condition are able to maintain a positive attitude and continue to look for the future and not give up. Now, one of the things that he credits with the ability to keep going was, even though the Vietnamese did the best they could to keep them separated and keep them from communicating, they found ways to communicate with each other and to say, hey, yes, I know what you're going through. The same thing happened to me. Keep resisting. We can get through this and keep going, which I'm sure allowed for be able to take a lot more than if somebody was just completely by themselves and isolated. They had come up with many different types of tortures to try to get people to talk. One of the, what he calls the worst one, is the ropes. They would tie ropes, tie your hands behind your back, tie ropes very tight around your biceps to the point where your circulation would be cut off. And he said it felt like your arms were in boiling water. And he found that a lot of people couldn't take that for very long. On the 21st of February, I was put in the ropes for the first time. I managed to last about 24 hours before I concluded I could stand no more pain and would have to agree to answer their questions with my cover story. I had managed to drag it out almost 6 months from the day I was captured. So with the methods that were employed, they all knew that eventually they would reach a point where they would break and they would have to answer questions just to get it to stop. So what most of them did was they came up with a fake backstory. So they basically just told a bunch of lies. It's like, okay, when I can't take it anymore, I'll tell you a bunch of lies. Now, they're going to go take time to check, and they'll find that they're lies, but that gets you out of it for right now. And he justified that, saying, well, if they're willing to torture and threaten to kill me, I think I feel justified in lying about it. So this went on for quite a bit of time. They came up with different ideas. One night in July of 1966... they rounded a whole bunch of them up and put them in trucks and took them into downtown Hanoi, into the Hanoi Stadium. Now, these people thought that they were thrown, because they were blindfolded and thrown in the back of a truck, they figured they were taken to be executed. So once they were taken out of the trucks and the blindfolds were taken off, they saw what was going on, and they were... It says, when the trucks stopped, we were unloaded from the trucks and our handcuffs and blindfolds were removed, and we found ourselves in Hanoi Stadium. As I looked around, I could envision thousands of screaming Vietnamese filling the stands to witness the public executions. I'm sure the others were thinking the same thing when Ed Davis said, well, the Christians are here. Where are the lions? So even in a dire situation, people can still find a way to find the to make humor in the situation. So what ended up happening is they were paraded through the streets of Hanoi with the Vietnamese throwing rocks and bottles and all kinds of stuff at them and, of course, shouting at them. Because they were being pushed and prodded, all they had on their feet were rubber sandals made from old tires. Some people had lost their sandals, and so they had their feet shredded from stepping on the glass and the rocks. But eventually they took them back in the prisons, and that's all that had happened to them. And for a good side, this was publicized, and the video made it around the world, and from those films, the Americans were able to identify 20 people that had originally been thought to be killed in action. So they could say, well, at least they're alive. So things go on for more years. The tides of war change. We increase the bombing campaigns in North Vietnam. And when we get into the fall, or into 1972, things start to change. By November of 1972, things were starting to look very differently. They were being treated better. They were giving better food. The guards started to say things like, when you get home, remember that we're all kind of in this together. And, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, don't come back and try to kill us. In February of 1973, they were loaded up and taken to the airport. Now, again, these are people that had been there for 7.5 years and had all kinds of tricks played on them. So even though they were given civilian clothing, new clothing, you know, more food, fattened up a little bit, and taken to the airport, they didn't really believe that they were going to be going home, but they, you know, you want to believe. So it said, as previously planned, we formed up in ranks and marched to the exchange point. As our names were read, we were met by an Air Force colonel in his blue uniform. We noticed how sharp he looked compared to the V in their wrinkled, ill-fitting uniforms. We exchanged salutes, then were escorted to the first C-141. Once inside, we were greeted warmly by flight nurses and fellow airmen. We were still rather subdued, not quite believing that this could really be happening. When we actually got airborne and the gear came up, we had a tremendous celebration with a lot of cheering and shouting. Again, when the pilot announced that we were feet wet and out of North Vietnamese airspace, we went wild. We realized that our dream of Freedom Day had finally come. So, I mean, those of us that have never been in that situation can certainly not understand what those people felt as they were finally going home. Reverting that to the Christian life, when we get our reward, it will be, as Paul has told us, greater than anything we could possibly suffer here on earth. Now, Wes was also lucky, again, of the people that came out, not everybody had a really happy reunion when they came home. Fortunately, Wes did. He found out a few days later that on February 16th, I flew to Travis Air Force Base in the same C-141 that had brought me out of Hanoi. The crew told me that when leaving Hanoi on that first day, they had received a message for me from a Northwest Airlines 747 going to Manila. The airline captain said, "Welcome home, Wes. Thought you'd like to know your seniority number is 428 out of 1,550, and you could be flying captain on a 27 or 707. Sure glad to have you back, even though you're senior to me." So, of course, the whole time he's in captivity, he's not really thinking about his career once he gets home. But now, all of a sudden, he finds out that not only did his previous employer remember about him, he was left on the roll, so he gained seniority the whole time he was there. And so he thought, boy, this is a really great thing to happen. After a short period of time, he was given a clean bill of health by the Air Force flight surgeons. So he went to talk to the people at Northwest, and they said, "Yep, we want you to come back." He was a little nervous because, of course, he hadn't flown in over 7.5 years. He's like, "Gee, do I even still know how to fly an airplane?" So he went up with an instructor and did some time, and he said, "Sure enough, I can remember how to do this." So he went back to Northwest. He says he separated from the Air Force on 17th of August. 3 days later, I began ground school to check out as a Northwest 727 captain. He spent, I don't know why he couldn't have put it in the same place. Again, he had a longer career with Northwest than I would have ever thought. He spent several years as a 27 captain, went on to DC-10, and then retired after 13 years as a 747 captain. Then he got out and formed the Blackjack Squadron at Arlington. And had a very, very full career. So as I'm reading through this story, I'm thinking of several things that parallel what a Christian's life is. Now, our struggle is not a physical one like that, well, at least for most people, and you know, we should be thankful for that. But the consequences of failing in our struggle are even more dire than Wes's work. It all boils down to hope. In Matthew 26, or not Matthew, it's Acts 26. I don't know why I wrote Matthew. In Acts 26, Paul is making his defense to Agrippa, and he's talking about hope. What he says is, "And now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers, the promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. For this hope, O king, I am being accused by the Jews." Now, this kind of hope that Paul is talking about is not mere human hope. It is not just, "Gee, I hope it doesn't get too hot today," or "I hope my team wins the big game." This is hope that has something behind it. According to Thayer, this Greek word elpis, or elpis, I think it's pronounced, rarely in a bad sense of an expectation of evil or fear, much more frequently in the classics and always in the New Testament in a good sense, an expectation of good, hope, and in the Christian sense, joyful and confident expectation of eternal salvation. So that is the hope that Paul is talking about. He's talking about the hope of spending the eternity with Christ. That is the hope that we have before us. Now, of course, Wes's big hope was to survive and get back to see his family again, which he did. And that was, you know, you can imagine the kind of joy that he felt when he received that. So how much greater will the joy be for a Christian when we achieve our hope of eternity with Christ? And then the final thought that I want to leave you with is from a very familiar passage in Matthew 7, 13, and 14, which I don't have, but I'm sure you're familiar with it, where it says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who find it. But the gate is narrow that leads to salvation, and few are there that find it." So we find that there's many that go through the wide gate, few that manage to find the narrow gate. So, of course, my response to that is we should take a look around on our road in life and see where we are. If it looks like we're going the same direction as everybody else, we're probably going the wrong way. And we might want to think about checking the GPS again. And the thought is Satan doesn't have to worry about the many that are entering through the wide gate because he's already got them. But he focuses all of his efforts on those of us trying to enter through the narrow gate. So we have to constantly be on alert. That's why if you read through the New Testament, how often do you read, "Be alert, be on guard, keep watch"? It's something that you have to actively try to do because there are forces that are trying to get us to do things that we knew we shouldn't so that we don't end up achieving that hope of the eternal life in Christ. So, I hope that I was able to show how one man's struggles kind of epitomize the type of spiritual struggles that Christians face on a daily basis and get us to, you know, kind of think about it and realize that active participation is required for faithfulness as a Christian so that we can think about consciously doing that on a daily basis. Like I said, wake up in the morning and determine that today I'm going to follow Christ. At this time, if there's anyone in the congregation who is in need of the prayers or wants to respond to the invitation that Christ has made, this would be an opportune time to do that. As together we stand and sing the song that has been selected, which I believe on the board is song number 175.